thank Philip for inviting me. It came at a very opportune time, and I really enjoyed going back and revisiting that old paper of mine and trying to improve it for this conference. When I began teaching quantum mechanics many years ago, I discovered that it was often the best students who resisted learning the subject because they were offended by the Hilbert space model being just pulled out of the hat. And what I tried to do was to find ways to motivate the Hilbert space model by trying to derive as much as possible from experiments. And this is what led me into this project. When I began thinking about it, I've always been very influenced by geometry, and so I focused on geometrical methods, as you'll see, both projective geometry and metric geometry. As you all know, the quantum logic axiomatization has some very bad limitations to it. In fact, it doesn't give us anything at all in the most interesting case, namely two dimensions. And in the case of three dimensions, it allows all kinds of wild, exotic coordinatizations of the projective plane. You can have anything from a planar ternary ring to a Mufang plane or whatever, but none of the, there's no way to get to the field that we know and love, namely the complex numbers. And also, there's no way to get the Born rule because Gleason's theorem doesn't give us anything at all in dimension two. And in higher dimensions, it relies on the Hilbert space model to work. So I began thinking in terms of metric geometry. As we learned from Gauss, the best way to understand what's going on in a surface is to make metrical measurements. And so the question is, what is the analog of that in quantum mechanics? Well, the analog would be the simplest kind of measurements that you make with polarizers and analyzers. So you have these filters labeled by here X and Y, and you measure an intensity ratio, and you see what that's like as a function of X and Y. And you try to learn about the structure of what's going on by the behavior of this function. I just gave an example here. Okay, let me get where I can see a little better, perhaps. Oh, now I'm blocking you. So the first thing you have to do is to decide on a criterion for when you consider two filters identical. And the obvious way to do that is to say that they're identical if they produce the same effect in all experiments. And this suggests, here's this gadget. This suggests this metric. And this is an amazing kind of a metric. It works for almost anything. You don't have to assume anything at all about P to deduce that this thing is a metric. I mean, all you need to know is that assume is that P belongs to a valuation ring, to a valuation ring of some kind, for this to make sense. So you could, in principle, even use it for p-adic numbers or other exotic things. In fact, since those intensity ratios are rational numbers, if you do count, if you're doing counting of the photons coming through, the ratios are rational numbers. So in fact, you could start playing games with this by imagining that the p's are p-adic numbers, and this metric would make sense. Anyway, the first thing I discovered about it was that it remarkably makes a distinction immediately between quantum mechanics and hidden variables. That is, if you calculate a, where's this thing? Okay, what's going on? If you calculate this thing in the Hilbert space model, that is using this for p, you find that the d function is a square root of 1 minus p. But in hidden variable theories, you get, there's no square root on the right-hand side. So immediately you have the contradiction between hidden variable models and quantum mechanics. And the Bell inequality is merely the triangle inequality for the second metric. And in fact, that was that got me started actually on this in a way on this line of development, because when I first saw the Bell inequality, it jumped out at me that it must be a triangle inequality of some kind. So I started looking for that, and I wrote a paper in 1991. In fact, yeah. Are you talking about comparing it to Bell's inequality? Oh, you have to change variables. The capital P that Bell uses is related to this little p, by p equals 1 minus capital P over 2 or something like that. And then you get the Bell inequality in the usual form. Okay. So let's just quickly run through what it is we want to reproduce in reconstructing the conventional model. The conventional model says that the space of states is complex projective space of n dimensions with elements represented by complex coordinate vectors. And it's equipped with the notions of dimension and subspace. And a pair of distinct elements span a two-dimensional subspace, which is a complex projective line. And a basis can be found in which the first two components are the only non-vanishing ones. So you represent the states then by two homogeneous coordinates, where those coordinates are complex numbers, and two vectors differing by a complex multiple are identified, and the Dirac kets are defined by multiplying by a normalization. So the states are put in one-to-one correspondence with the points of the compactified complex plane. So you allow Z to be infinite, and it makes sense still. Then the complex plane is the image of the Riemann sphere by stereographic projection. And so the kets are in 1-1 correspondence with the points on the Riemann sphere. And then once you do that by direct calculation, you get the relationship between norm squared of x and y with the cosine of xy over cosine squared of xy over 2, where xy is the angle subtended at the center of the sphere by a great circle arc joining x and y. This is just a mathematical statement which identifies the Fubini study metric with the usual metric on the sphere. So there's no physics yet. The physics is supplied by the Born rule, and in optics, the Riemann sphere is called the Poincaré sphere, or some people call the Bloch sphere. And that formula relating P to the geometry on the sphere is called Malou's law. So this is all very familiar. Okay, now what I'm going to do in reconstructing the theory from the data that we get from those filtration experiments is we start with just a set of labels, and I'm going to find a minimal set of properties of the table of those filtration experiments, which do the following. First of all, we want to furnish S with the notions of dimension and subspace. And we want to, in other words, we've got to extract properties from the P-table which do all these jobs. It furnishes the space of labels with the notions of dimension and subspace, and imply that every two-dimensional subspace is a complex projective line. That is, the points x are going to be in 1-1 correspondence with the points of the points on the Riemann sphere. And thirdly, that correspondence, and this is the key, the correspondence must be such that p of xy is related to the geometry on the sphere in the way that the Hilbert space model predicts. Then we need to extract enough to prove that every three-dimensional subspace is a projective plane, and use the complex structure of its CP2 subspaces to show that it is a complex projective plane. So, from projective geometry, we know that an n-dimensional space such that all three-dimensional subspaces are planes is a CPN space. We then proceed, as in the conventional model, to arrive at the formula that's given there. But now we've established that P of xy is cosine squared xy over 2, so we then have proved the Born rule. That is, this is the way in which we extract the Born rule from the calculation. Okay, so let me run through some definitions now. First of all, I want to make it clear that this definition of a mixture is a formal definition. I'm not assuming that there's any vector space structure here. This is just a notation that says M is a mixture consisting of alpha j parts of the filter xj, and the sum of the alphas should be 1. And the attenuation of the mixture by a z filter is the obvious expression. And in the same way as we decided when two states are equal, two mixtures are indistinguishable if they give the same result in all filtration experiments. So, we need another couple definitions. We say that states are orthogonal if P of xy is 0. And a basis is a maximal set of mutually orthogonal states. And notice that the orthogonal states are maximally separated in the D metric. That is, the D metric has values from 0 to 1, takes on the value 0 when two things are identical, and it reaches its maximum of 1 when the two are orthogonal. A balanced mixture of two states is an equal, as a mixture with an equal amount of two not necessarily orthogonal states. A normal mixture is a mixture of two orthogonal states, but with not necessarily equal amounts. So those are going to be the two simple kinds of mixtures that we'll consider. And a maximally unpolarized mixture consists of equal amounts of the states belonging to a basis. And we know what a basis is now. Okay. The following are the assumptions that I'm, the following are the properties, rather, that I am going to assume about the P table. And these are all checkable by experiment in principle. The obvious ones at the top are symmetry. P of xx is equal to 1, and P of xy is equal to P of yx. That is, on your table, all the diagonals on the table will be 1, and the table will be symmetric in the interchange of x and y. Other speakers have said, we avoid the case of infinite dimensions. A Hilbert space of infinite dimensions is not even locally compact, so it should be avoided at all costs. And the way I say that is that there is just at most a finite number of elements in every basis, but that's the same thing as saying that S is the space of labels is compact in the topology of the metric D. Okay, now the last two are the key ones. The first indistinguishability property is that maximally unpolarized statistical mixtures are indistinguishable. We all know that an equal mixture of left and right circularly polarized light cannot be distinguished from an equal mixture of up and down polarization. Generalizing this to n dimensions, we have the first indistinguishability property. The second one is that every balanced mixture is indistinguishable from some normal mixture. That turns out to be the real key to the whole thing. That is, as I'll remark later, the first indistinguishability property can be exhibited by hidden variable models. You can find models that have property 3, but you cannot find any that have property 4. Okay, so now, once I assume that, I'm going to first run through the important consequences of the first indistinguishability property. The first is that all bases have the same number of elements, and so we can now call that the dimension of the system. The proof is very simple. Here's a statement of the indistinguishability property. You insert z equals to xn here, and then you only get one term on the left side when xk is equal to, when k is equal to little n, and you sum over n, and you get this expression. If you insert z equals ym and sum over it, you get the expression with n prime and n interchanged, and since we have that symmetry p of xy equal p of yx, interchanging gives. So you've deduced now that there is a well-defined dimension in the system. The second is the frame function property that is the gives you the probabilistic interpretation. The proof of that is, again, very, very simple. Now we can set capital N equal N prime in the first indistinguishability property equation and let the basis be obtained by, let one of the bases be obtained by adjoining elements to obtain a maximal set. You can always do that because we've proved that every maximal set has capital N elements, and so if you only've got a few elements that are orthogonal to one another, you can always add others. Otherwise, the previous set would have been not been maximal, would have been the maximal one, which would be a contradiction. So you can always do that, and once you do that, it's very then easy to get to the next the statement of the frame function property. Now the meaning of subspace is supplied in a very obvious way. You pick any set of mutually orthogonal states, and you define the subspace that they span as a set of states for which the sum is equal to 1. And then you show that any basis that you choose for that subspace gives the same summation. That is, you have, if you have the basis Vj and the basis Wj, the summation will be the same for both. And again, it's sort of obvious that follows from the frame function property, because if you sum, you just simply adjoin to those two bases enough to fill up the whole space, and then you just subtract the two frame function properties. And that leaves you with an identity. In other words, what I'm saying is you can adjoin the same set of elements to these as you adjoin to these in order to give you a basis for the whole space. So when you subtract the two frame function equations, all those extra terms disappear and you're left with this identity. This is very important. This plays a big role in especially when we come to generalizing from two dimensions to three. Anyway, so what this says is that the indistinguishability property that we had assumed for a maximal unpolarized mixtures applies to unpolarized mixtures which just involve the set of elements belonging to a subset. So you really have a whole family of indistinguishabilities that come out of this. It's a little bit surprising, but anyway. This is the proof of that. I think I'll just skip that. The next property, which is, again, very important and simple to prove, is that for every element in a two-dimensional subspace, there is a unique element which is its orthogonal complement, and I call that the antipode if the first state is A, its antipode we indicate by A prime. Okay. All right. One further consequence, Bogdan Mielnik in his development starts off identifying states if they satisfy the identity that P of XY is equal to 1, which is obviously an easier way to check identity than mine, because mine I had to prove that P of XZ equals P of YZ for all Z, which is clearly not so easy to do, whereas this is a very easy one to do. But I was actually able to derive this from the other one, so we have it available anyway. Okay. All right. So as I remarked, it's possible to construct hidden variable theories that satisfy the first indistinguishability property, but we shall see that no hidden variable theory can satisfy the second. So let's now turn to the second indistinguishability property and explore its consequences. Okay. Yeah.
Can you repeat the second one? It is that
a balanced mixture is equivalent to some a normal mixture. Here's the equation that says it, right here. Okay. We have the mixture a half of A and B. And then we apply, of course, to each state. We're doing a filtration experiment, right? Sending that mixture through a Z filter, okay? And here on the other side, it says that for any A and B, there exists a pair CC prime, that is, and a normal mixture of them, but with not necessarily equal amounts, okay? So this is the statement of that second indistinguishability property. All right. No. I mean, again, what we're trying to do is to find a minimal set of properties of the P table from which we can deduce the conventional model. Now, we have to get interference into the game somehow. Since we don't have Hilbert space, we don't have phase. We don't know what phase means. So interference has to come in some way that's expressible directly in terms of this P function. Well, how can you find interference effects in the P table? By finding that certain combinations produce the same result as other combinations. In other words, you have two different ways of preparing a mixture. And yet you're getting the same result in all experiments. That's just like what waves do. I mean, you can add together, you can put together different combinations of waves that give you the same result. That's a way of seeing interference. And what I simply discovered was that this was the simplest property that I could find that turned out to have the desired consequences. Okay? So, just think of it as a way of getting interference into the game without having Hilbert space at your available for you. Okay. So the first thing we deduce is that given any pair of distinct elements, there's a unique two-dimensional subspace containing them. And this is one of the requirements of a projective geometry, that two distinct points determine a line, okay? So the subspace of A generated by two distinct elements is going to be our projective line, right? Now, to see that they form a two-dimensional subspace, notice that if any state is orthogonal to both A and B, this left side would be zero. And since these numbers are positive, that means both of these terms have to be zero. So that Z would be orthogonal to both C and C prime, okay, and therefore it would be orthogonal to that subspace. And therefore, we proved that the two-dimensional subspace that the subspace spanned by PAB is the same as, so it's a two-dimensional subspace. Okay, I'll skip the proof of uniqueness. It's again very straightforward, but it would take about 5 minutes, and I don't think it's worth going through that. Okay, now this is the next slide is very important. It's lambda and c that appear in that equation do not depend on z. They depend only on a and b. You're making a statement that, remember the statement of the principle was that an equal mixture, that a balanced mixture produces the same effects as a certain normal mixture. When you're checking the effect it produces, you're applying it to a filter Z, okay? So there is no requirement that when you change Z that you change lambda and C. And so therefore you can get information out of this by substituting, or you can get information about lambda and C by substituting different values of Z. So in particular, you can substitute Z equals A, Z equals B, and Z equals C. Now in all those cases, the things you're substituting belong to that subspace spanned by C and C prime. So you can assume in this equation that P of CZ plus P of C prime Z is equal to 1, because all these Z's are going to be in the subspace spanned by C and C prime. So you can plug that into this into the equation that I wrote before to eliminate C prime in terms of C. And so you get a simplified version of that equation, which I call the restricted equation. It only applies when Z belongs to the subspace spanned by AB, or equivalent by CC prime. Now, one thing you can immediately check, you notice that this equation becomes not so interesting when lambda is equal to a half, because this term goes away. Well, it's easy to check that lambda equals a half corresponds to the case where A and B are antipodes of one another. So you can treat that case separately and then assume lambda is not equal to half for the rest of this derivation. Okay? So if I apply the restricted equation to Z equals A, B, or C and use the symmetry and the P of XX equals 1, you start getting some interesting stuff. Okay, so I've actually written out the equations here. I've substituted Z for A, and then I get this equation. If I substitute Z equals B, I get this equation. Now, because P of AB is equal to P of BA, the two right-hand sides are equal automatically. They are identical, and if these two terms are the same, then you can equate, you get the result that PAB is equal to, I'm sorry, you get the result that PAC is equal to PCB, because you get the same result when you substitute for A and for B. And now finally, put in C equals Z, and you get this equation, and if you combine that with this, you get an equation for lambda that you can then solve and show that lambda is equal to this quantity. Now that doesn't look so so interesting, but it becomes interesting if we make this change of variables. Suppose that I define this quantity theta by this equation that relates it to our P of xy. Now this is just a definition of theta of xy. So far it doesn't have any particular meaning, but when we plug that into the equation, those identities that I got on the last slide, these things that PCA equals PCB and that lambda is equal to that, turns into a very simple set of equations. It says that the angle, I'm sorry, I should bite my tongue, I'm not supposed to call it an angle yet. We obtain the identity that theta of AC equals theta of CB, and that each of them is one half of theta of AB, and that lambda is related to A and B in this simple way. Okay? Now, at this point, I want to check to see whether I'm making progress. So we know that the relationship of the D metric to P is a sign of the difference between hidden variable theories and the Hilbert space model. So let's see whether we can calculate that relationship from the data we have. And here are the steps in doing that. I guess I should remind you of what the D metric was. I want to go all the way back there. Let's see. It involved taking the absolute value of the supremum of P of XZ minus P of YZ, and taking the absolute value and then taking the supremum over Z. Okay? Well, if you take advantage of the fact, well, one of our identities in our earlier discussion was to show that you have two different bases of the same subspace, that these two quantities are equal. In other words, B and B prime are bases for the PAB subspace, because remember, every subspace that contains an element contains its antipode. So you can use B and B prime as a basis, as well as C and C prime, and so you have this identity. And if you replace P of B of Z with this, in the equation that we had, in that SIP, second indistinguishable property equation, you get, it simplifies, it turns into this expression. And now if you take the absolute value on both sides and take the supremum of the absolute values, you get this equation. And then finally, it results in a square root of 1 minus PAB prime, because PAB and PAB prime differ by, I mean, the sum of those two is equal to 1, so you get this. Now interchange B and B prime in the argument, and you get the dependence of D, which is characteristic of quantum mechanics. That is, the D is the square root of 1 minus P. So we clearly are on the right track here, because we can prove from this data that the metric has the right relationship to the probability function, the attenuation function. Yeah? The step to go from?
The 2 lambda minus 1 on the bottom of the
formula. This one? Oh, yeah, okay, right here?
Down further.
Okay.
The 2 lambda minus 1.
Oh, you see, C and C prime are antipodes, so the distance between them is 1.
Yeah, so that step is good, but what about the step from 2 lambda minus 1 modulus
of? To here?
From there
to the next step. To here. Here. Oh, remember on the last slide, sorry, we had in terms of here, we substitute that in, okay? Okay, so I got very excited when I saw this, and a number of my colleagues didn't believe it. So I had a lot of fun with it when this dropped out. Okay, now we come to a real surprise. When I make that substitution for P in terms of theta, that is, express P of xy as cosine squared of theta over 2, and I plug that into that restricted equation, it takes on a really interesting form. You use the cosine squared identity, that cosine squared is 1 plus of theta is 1, cosine squared of theta over 2 is the square root of 1 plus cosine theta all divided by 2. You use that over and over in the equation, and it simplifies to this form. Well, when I saw that, it rang sort of a bell that it looks very much like a theorem in spherical trigonometry. There's a theorem that says that if you take If you take a spherical triangle with vertices A, B, and Z, there's this identity. If AZ is the angle subtended at the center by the points A and Z, and so on, then they are related to the arc to that angle for the midpoint between the midpoint of A and B and Z. Okay, so you have this length is related to this length, and it's just sort of like one that I'm trying to think. There's one in plane geometry that's somewhat similar to it. It eludes me at the moment. Maybe the law, not the law of sines, maybe the law of cosines or something. But nobody studies spherical trig anymore. So I was really lucky to remember that. Anyway, so now this gave me a really important tool. Let's agree to say that states X and Y are properly mapped to a sphere if the images, if their images are joined by a great circle R, which subtends the angle XY. Remember, capital X, capital Y means the angle subtended at the center of the sphere by the points X and Y. Okay? And let's agree to say that a set of states will be properly mapped if every pair of them is properly mapped. And then we'll say that a state is properly adjoined to a properly mapped set if the resulting set remains properly matched, mapped after you've added this one, this additional point. Okay, then you can check that if A belongs to a properly mapped set, its antipode can be properly adjoined by mapping it to the antipode A prime of A on the sphere. Okay? So, now what do? All right? Suppose that we have three states, A, B, and C, contained in the subspace spanned by AB that's properly mapped. Then the equation that I got before takes on this form. Remember, I had thetas here. I had theta of AZ and theta of BZ and theta of AB. But now we're assuming that A, B, and Z are properly mapped, which means I can replace those thetas by the arc lengths. Okay? Except for C now here. I haven't assumed anything about it, and so it's still sitting here as theta of CZ. But now when I compare that with the spherical triangle formula, we get the theta of CZ is equal to CZ, capital CZ. So it's it is going to be properly mapped because we had already, another one of the relations we had was this thing relating theta of CA to theta of AB. But since we've assumed that AB are properly mapped, we can replace this theta by capital AB, the angle, right? So now we got that C is actually the midpoint of the arc. You see, we have theta of CA now equals CA, capital CA, theta of CB equals capital CB. And so all of the relations, and we have theta of CZ is equal to capital CZ. And so we've proved now we've proved this result. Which I think is one of the most important results we've gotten. It says that if the set of states ABZ is properly mapped to the vertices of a spherical triangle, there is a state C which can be properly adjoined by mapping it to the midpoint. Okay. The degenerate case is where we have just two points which are properly mapped, and then on a circle, and then there's a state C which can be properly adjoined by mapping it to the midpoint C of capital AB. So, and we can also adjoin the antipodes. And so here's what the degenerate case looks like. What it says is that you can map these points onto a circle, starting with AB, you can adjoin C and C prime, but then you can start with C and B and adjoin the midpoint of it Then you can take B and A prime and join the midpoint of it, and you keep on doing this over and over again. And what happens now is you cover the circle in the limit of, you cover the circle with a dense set of images of your space of labels. So you generate a set of states which are proper, which is properly mapped to a dense set of points on the circle. Now, in order to start that process, we need a pair, AB, that are properly mapped to a circle. And here is a very simple one that's always at your disposal. If you take the points corresponding where the function p of xy is a half, you can map x to one point on the circle and y to a point at right angles to it, so that cosine squared of xy over 2 is half, and so they are properly matched. So if you take a point and a point on the equator, which is halfway, you know, a quarter of the way around, then they're automatically going to be properly matched. Okay? So that gets you started. You can't, I'm sorry. So, all right. So the equator opposite any state consists of a point and its antipode. So there are just two elements in any mutually equatorial set in this case. Now, suppose there are three states such that, which are equatorial. That is, suppose that you have a sphere, and then you have A and F, E and F are all at right angles to each other, so they're automatically properly mapped. Because in each one of those cases, the arc is going to be pi over 2, so when you calculate cosine squared of xy over 2, you get a half, right? So you can then play the same game on the sphere that you played on the circle, that is, keep on adding midpoints, which I've shown here. If I have E, F, and A, I can take the midpoint of F and E, F and A, and then connect them and take midpoints again, and keep on doing this until you fill the sphere up with points. So what you can do depends on how many states can be in a mutually equatorial set. So now, if the only states which lie on the equator, let me back up. If the only states that lie on the equator of A are all on this circle, then that's as far as you can go. And if you've then exhausted all of the points in that subset P of AB, then what you've proved is that there is a 1-1 correspondence between your set of states and the points on the sphere. Okay. So in the case of in the real case, you have only two states on which are relatively equatorial. You can't add any more that would be equatorial to both of them. But in the complex case, there's a third state, 1i, which is equatorial to both of these. And so you have, in complex quantum mechanics, you have three mutually equatorial states. And so you get a sphere. If you have only two equatorial states, you get a circle. If you had quaternions, you would have 1j and 1k that you could add to this, and you'd have your equator would not be a sphere, would be a higher, your equator wouldn't be a circle, it would be a sphere. Okay, so that's a very interesting feature of this way of looking at things, that it identifies the ground field with the number of states in a mutually equatorial set. Okay. Incidentally, if we choose the sphere to have unit diameter and you substitute that identity, that P of xy, we've now proved that P of xy is equal to cosine squared capital XY over 2. If you plug that in here, you get the sine of a half XY, which is the length of the chord joining the two points on the sphere. So we see now what the geometry is. The D metric is the chord metric on the sphere. Okay. All right, now to complete the reconstruction, we have to show that the results above for two-dimensional subspaces imply the conventional model for all dimensions. Okay, to do that, what we have to prove is that the three-dimensional subspaces are complex, are CP3, or the three-dimensional subspaces are CP3. That is, we have to prove that two lines intersect at only one point. We already know that two points are on a line, but we have to prove that in every three-dimensional subspaces, two lines intersect once and only once. Okay? That establishes that it's a projective plane. Okay? Anyway, it turns out that follows from the these properties. Let's see. Let me skip to the proof that every pair of lines intersect once and only once. See, it goes like this. The two lines are X prime and A prime. Okay, these are two one-dimensional subspaces. Okay, we want to prove that they have a point in common. It's going to be this X star prime. Okay, how's it go? Well, X double prime and A double prime define a two-dimensional subspace, and the antipode of X double prime has to be on that line, but if it's orthogonal to X double prime, it has to lie on XX prime, because this is a three-dimensional space that XX prime and X double prime span. So X star has to be on XX prime. But on that line, it has an antipode, X star prime. Well, X star prime is orthogonal to both X star and X double prime. I'm sorry, yeah, it's orthogonal to both, because it's on XX prime, it's orthogonal to X double prime. It's also orthogonal to X star. And therefore, it's orthogonal to everything on that line. I didn't mention that was another consequence. If a point is orthogonal to two points on a line, it's orthogonal to everything on that line. So this thing is orthogonal to A double prime. But that means it must lie on AA prime, and therefore it's the intersection between AA prime and XX prime. So that proves that two lines intersect at one point. They can't intersect at two points because then they'd be identical, because one line is determined by two points. So that completes that part of the story. Okay, now that we know it's a projective plane, we can now coordinatize it in the standard way. This is a familiar construction in projective geometry, where you want to coordinatize the plane. You base it on a coordinate system that you've established on the lines on three intersecting lines. But since we've already proved that the two-dimensional subspaces are complex lines, that means the parameters, the coordinates, are complex numbers. So therefore, we're going to show that we can coordinatize in dimension three with complex numbers, and therefore we have a Papian plane, that is, one in which Pappus's theorem holds. That means that it's if you know this from projective geometry, if a plane is coordinatized by a field, Pappus's theorem holds. If it's not coordinatized by, if, for example, it was coordinatized by quaternions, Pappus's theorem would fail. Right. So we've established that every three-dimensional subspace is a Papian plane, and that establishes that the space is CPN. That is, the whole space is a complex projective space, which is what Hilbert space is. So, let me. Oops, that's a. That's. I want to go back to. No, I don't know where I have that slide. If you recall what we did in the case of the conventional model, once we had CPN, okay, we took two states and we looked at the two-dimensional subspace that they spanned, and we got, I guess that's what I should really do. Does anybody know how you get back to the beginning of these things? What button you push? Huh? Just keep on clicking, all right. Oops, went too far. Yeah. Yeah, okay. What we did was, once we had CPN, we look at a two-dimensional subspace, and we arrived, oh boy, we arrived at this formula. Now what we've done is to prove that P of XY is this right-hand side. We proved that P of XY is related to the geometry on the sphere by being identical with cosine squared XY over 2. But once you had CPN and you went down to two dimensions, you showed that you could get XY squared equal cosine squared XY over 2. So therefore, we've proved that P of XY is the left-hand side, which is Born's rule. So we've gotten Born's rule, so to speak, through the back door. By identifying the transition or the attenuation function with this geometry, we connect it with this quantity in Hilbert space, which is also connected to the geometry in this way. And so that completes the story. Let's see, I had a couple more remarks and ready to stop. If you've never seen the proof that the Hilbert space model gives that square root in the relationship to the transition function, here it is. It's kind of cute. You have trace of pi of x, pi of z is just xz squared, modulus squared, and this would be x, yz modulus squared. So you can write it this way. It's the expectation value of pi of x minus pi of y in the state z, and then take the supremum of that. But that's the largest eigenvalue of pi of x minus pi of y. And if you take the cube of that, and use the fact that these are projection operators, so that pi of x squared is pi of x, you get this identity. Okay? And now you can just read off the eigenvalues. Just apply, you'll get a simple equation for the eigenvalues of this operator, and then you'll get that this quantity is the square root of this, and that proves the relationship that d is equal to the square root of 1 minus p. Well, in the hidden variable case, it goes like this. Here's that standard form of the Bell inequality. Here it goes. You get the expression for the probability that you get through a Y filter if it's been selected by an X filter in a hidden variable theory is calculated from the measure that is, you have, if lambda X is a set of hidden variables for which it gets through an X filter, and lambda Y is a set of hidden variables for which it gets through a Y filter, and then you have the measure of the intersection of the two, that's the way you compute P of XY in a hidden variable theory. Well, if you evaluate that, you'll see that supremum of the difference just works out to be 1 minus P of XY. And so you get that relationship. And you asked before about Bell's inequality. This is the, if you make the substitution P of XY equals 1 minus capital P over 2, then it gives you the form that you probably recognize for Bell's inequality. Okay, I think that's all I have to say. Thank you.
We have time for questions. that some of the fellow that has one point you might be able to help you with. You were able to show that there's a good mapping for a two-dimensional subspace, sort of circle. You talked about it would be nice to, you might be able to extend this to map consistently to a whole sphere, so a whole heap of circles can fit on the same sphere. But then you said it really depends how, I might not exhaust my whole set of propositions, and there might be, it depends how many independent equatorial points or something like that. And then you said, well, now you get the reals or the contacts or the turnings, but then you ended up only with the contacts. Did you really show there is a consistent mapping always, or
yeah,
is there an assumption?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a system in which you have only two states in an equatorial set, then you can map everything to a circle. If you have three in an equatorial set, then you can map everything to a sphere. I proved that. Okay?
You might even need to tell your interest.
Well, I mean,
if I turn out that there's five for a set, what would you do then?
I guess I don't understand your question. Are you asking me to justify the number?
Yeah, I'm saying, does it matter if there were five in an equatorial set?
I can't because we don't know whether quaternionic quantum mechanics is of interest. But I mean, in other words,
it can't be just quaternionic. There might be 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 that come all equal.
No, I don't think so. I think after that, you no longer have a division ring. I mean, if you have the Cayley numbers, which would be the next step, you can have Cayley numbers in dimensions higher than 3. In dimensions higher than 3, you see, everything hinges in this business on your ability to embed a low dimension space in a higher dimension. And, you can't prove, for example, you can't prove Desargues' theorem without getting outside the plane. The plane has to be embedded in the free space before you can prove Desargues' theorem. And similarly, Pappus' theorem requires that you be able to embed in higher dimensional spaces. But as far as physics is concerned, some people believe in the possibility of quaternionic quantum mechanics. Steve Adler's written a whole book, about it. So there's no way I can rule that out other than by some additional assumption. That assumption could be that there are at most three states, or it could be actually my old paper that I wrote 15 years ago. I considered a dynamical argument to eliminate quaternions. Namely, if you have if you look at dynamical transformations that leave invariant a basis, okay, in the case of, let's say, on a sphere, they would be rotations about the sphere leaving invariant the north and the south pole. As long as the equator is a circle, that group is abelian. But if it were a sphere, the group of transformations that leaves the equator invariant would not be abelian. Okay, so it would be hard to define Hamiltonian mechanics. You couldn't say that transformations go by e to the minus iht, which is an abelian group. You couldn't do that. And I think Steve, in his book, has found some fancier kind of dynamics that works for quaternions. But I don't.
That's fine.
Okay.
Actually, I have one question. Consider, say, stellar mapping particle. You have these three measurements up versus down, right versus left, and this versus that, which we know exists. And now suppose that tomorrow someone discovered a new pure state of such a particle, that when you perform this measurement or this measurement or this measurement, you got 50-50.
On all of them.
So that would be a fourth equatorial, usually equatorial point then. Would your assumptions then imply that there must also be a fifth one? Because at that point,
you have
to jump to the quaternion?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, that would be
that's true.
You could not build a consistent.
That would get somebody a Nobel Prize.
Oh, yes. But you you couldn't stop at four. You'd have to
no.
Do, you'd have to do
that's right. That's a very good point.
Yeah. I'm just curious about the second in the SIP, the second mm-hmm. one. I mean, it seems a different model to the first one, as you said, in the sense that you have a hidden variable model that can give you the first one, the second. Can you give, I mean, did you try out sort of these early, the one that you finally chose?
It just seemed to be the simplest. You know, these two cases seem to be the simplest kinds of partially polarized mixtures. I mean, I played around with. Well, first I thought, well, maybe I even need more. You know, it's actually, if you take the sphere, every point inside of the sphere can define a mixture by taking the chord passing through that where it intersects the sphere, and then with appropriate weights on the two sides, you can get a mixture which is equivalent to every other mixture that's formed that way. So there's a huge number of indistinguishable mixture. And I played around with that for a while, but then I realized that all you needed was this, you know, this very simple example, and you got a huge amount out of it. I mean, the appearance of that spherical trig formula just came as a complete surprise to me. I mean, how did spherical geometry get into that? You know? So, you know, I just didn't see any need for anything more, but I do need something. So, I'm sorry?
Right at the outset, you define the symmetric as the distance between x and y. I'm just wondering how much the approach really depends on which is the symmetric.
The development of my model, I mean, my reconstruction doesn't depend on that at all. It's just a convenient tool for investigating it, of comparing different models. It's a wonderful tool to distinguish various models from one another. As we saw with, you know, Hilbert space and hidden variables, it's distinguished. So I could test my model with it, but it's not essential to the, not test my model, but test whether my axioms were sufficient to get the Hilbert space model. I can use it as a test for that.
I'm really struggling to understand why you're restricted to the two-dimensional case, you're restricted to certain, so that if we have two properties, why you're restricted to only certain cases of the hypersphere. You seem to be restricted to the circle of the sphere, and we have five. And this comes out of those initial axioms.
I have a bag full of labels, and I want to put them on, I want to see the geometry that's in them. Okay, so I find I can start transferring them to, let's say I start transferring them to a circle. I have two of them. And then I find there's a whole collection of those that go with those that get mapped onto a circle. Okay. When I'm finished, if the bag is not empty, that means that there must be something else that connects the North Pole to the South Pole, other than the ones that are on one particular meridian. So then I start filling up that circle, and then I find that I can then find other meridia in which all of these are consistent, and all of them are consistent. And then I fill up the sphere. Now, either I've run out of states, if I have run out of possible states on the equator to be able to put connect meridians to the North Pole, all right, then I'm finished. I've exhausted the whole bag of states. So then the next thing would be to see what the next kind of, how much bigger is the equator? That it's no longer a circle, but the equator is now a sphere, it's hard to visualize. But that would be the quaternion case. You would have an I, J, and K, and then you would exhaust that. You would have to exhaust that. But then there's no place else to go without violating something else.
What is it about?
Huh?
What are you violating?
Well, once you generate the projected space, you wouldn't be able to embed it in the higher dimensional space. You couldn't go. You'd wind up not being able to go from the CP, whatever it is for quaternions. What's quaternions? Q. The QPN. You wouldn't be able to go from QP2. Or 2P3 rather, to 2P4, and so on. That embedding would be impossible. You get a violation when you try to generate a plane that was coordinatized in that way and then embedded in a higher dimension.
What is it that demands that particular plane? Why can't they just think it's a succession of embeddings of RN, 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 plus one, and so on? From the original axis.
I'm not sure I understand.
Is it inconsistent with your axiom? Do you still have stuff left over after time you
go to conclusion?
Can you tell me what you're getting at this? Well, that's not fully quaternion. So let's just say we have a circle, then we have a sphere, then we have the next case of which is
a force.
Force here, 5, 6, 6,
yeah.
And so on. All of those are being embedded in part of the anywhere is different. So what is it that demands takes us outside that way of thinking about embedding in two?
No. You won't get a projected space. You won't get any kind of a Hilbert space.
So are we going to drive it all the space? So
We're trying to derive the Hilbert space that we know and love, right? That is the complex Hilbert space. Okay, we find, when we try to do that, we find there's also the possibility of a quaternionic Hilbert space, unless we introduce some other axioms. Okay, but if we try to go higher than that, there are problems, because the Cayley numbers, when you have a projective space of dimension three, then there's a certain limitation on the coordinatization. Okay, I mean you can have for it to be a projective plane, it has to be coordinatizable with a certain structure, which is called a planar ternary ring. Then you look for cases of Desargues' theorem. The more cases of Desargues' theorem, the closer that thing becomes to a field. And when it finally becomes a field, then it has all cases of Desargues' theorem, and then it can be embedded in a force space. Okay, but if it has a structure weaker than a field, which it would be for Cayley numbers, which are not even associative. They're not only not commutative, they're not associative. You won't be able to carry that through. You won't be able to coordinate the higher dimensional space.
Does all this mean you go through even just at the level of two orthogonal states?
Does it go through what?
At the level of two orthogonal states. Of the case where maximum numbers orthogonal states is two.
Then you get nothing from projective geometry. There's no...
Oh, so you have to go to that form to get...
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Projective geometry gives you no information about a line. It only gives you information once you have a point not on the line.
It's in the context of this discussion about complex numbers and quaternions. I remember there was an old paper by Cardi and Fedulo, which was also based on some metric arguments, where they actually justified complex numbers for H1. Is there any relation to this?
I'm not sure I understand.
There's an old paper by Cardi and Fedulo from 1981, where they justify the complex numbers by some metric arguments on the Bloch theorem. So
I'm not familiar with that.
And there they justify the complex numbers. I can't remember perfectly anymore what I've done to do. It was maybe an argument why the complex numbers, but also the quantum probability method on the sphere. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the argument. Maybe somebody else will remember
something. No, I'll.
It sort of resonated a little bit with your argument.
I'd like to see it if you can find the reference. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Questions? Well, yes, see, describe the second sort of indistinguishability principle, mm-hmm. that for every, you can have a normal mixture and a balanced mixture for every system. Mm-hmm. And then you said this is an instance of interference.
Yeah.
But it strikes me that, so I didn't see that connection. Maybe we're just using the word interference a different way. So does this kind of interference have anything to do with interference in a double slit experiment or the superposition principle? Excuse me, interference is something about pure states, where this is an assumption about mixed states. Mm-hmm. So how is it interference?
Well, if you look at the density matrices, you have cancellations in the off diagonal elements. And that's interference in that sense. And I mean, if you can relate that to the double slit experiment, you will see it. But you know, it's interesting that you have to get to the Hilbert space in order to be able to start adding vectors together, right? So the superposition principle doesn't come in until you actually have the Hilbert space. So you can play with sums and, you know, linear combinations of things being equal to other linear combinations of things. You don't have that available at the level of these labels. All you have is this p function, and so all you can do is look at combinations, real combinations of the states treated as formal objects. So these mixtures are, so to speak, formal linear combinations of the states. So. And they only have meaning when applied to a Z. In other words, you don't have all the machinery that you need to talk about double slits and stuff like that until you've generated the Hilbert space. I think that's its main use, is to be able to describe things like that. I think it's a very interesting question, I mean, to see, you know, whether you can recognize in these interferences some of these familiar examples. I'll think about that, actually.
I think there is a connection, but there's sort of a gap, I can't really think of the connection, but maybe I can sort of take you to sort of to the gap, which is, it seems to me that rather than using the Hilbert space and linear combinations in order to find a superposition, you can use the projective space, and as long as you have a group of transformations of the projective space, you can start talking about the superposition two points as being a transformation that doesn't take you all the way to the other point, but maybe the square root of the transformation would take you halfway to the other point. Mm-hmm. Because at that point is the superposition of these two points. And if there are many, you know, paths, then I have many notions of superposition which might correspond to different relative phases. Mm-hmm. That strikes me as very close to what you have, because when you have a balanced, you know, you have a mixed state, you're in a normal mixture, and then to say that there's also a balanced mixture seems to me to say there's a pure state which is somehow, you know, between the other two states. Mm-hmm. So as I say, there's a gap there, mm-hmm. but they have the same sort of field for them. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if the connection there is.
Yeah, that's, I think that's very worth thinking about that. Yeah. Thank you. I'll do that.
Let's thank Dan again.